Hey, podcast listeners, fans, people listening, it's Michael Shelley here. This episode is a special one. We've got Ron Hinkland as our guest. This guy is perhaps the most heard guest I've ever had. I think I've said that a bunch of times. Is it possible he's heard more than Mike Love or Brian Wilson? I don't know. His voice is on literally thousands of things, and I defy anyone listening to say they haven't heard this guy's voice. It's everywhere. It still is everywhere. I just love these kind of stories about how the studio system worked in the 70s and the 60s. And as I told Ron, he's just a super unusual guy, just a super unusual talent and attitude and combination. And I think that's why he was so successful for so long. There is a bonus feature at the end of this. After we were done with the interview, I asked him to stay on the phone and cut a few IDs for the show. So he was having some trouble kind of stumbling on the words and just, you know, good-natured about it. And he told me this funny story about the one time he tried to do a voiceover. So you'll hear that at the very end of the program. You'll hear the Love American-style theme, and then you'll hear him tell this story, which uses a word not suitable for the radio. So I didn't play this on the radio, but you get it here on the podcast, just kind of a special, I don't know, bonus edition. But I do want to also point out that this program was a two-hour Ron Hinkland fest. The entire 2 hours was songs, music, programming related to Ron, stuff he took part in, and the interview. So if you want to hear a whole, you know, almost hour of Ron Hinkland-related music, check the archive over at wfmu.org/Michael. Go Ron Hinkland crazy. Just greatest guy, great music, great stuff. Enjoy this, Ron Hinkland. All right, there are the Ron Hinkland singers from the soundtrack of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And right on the telephone, Ron Hinkland joins us from Hawaii. Aloha and good morning. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thank you. I'm still on the right side of the sod, as we say when we're playing golf. So, no, I'm doing fine and I'm enjoying life.
That's terrific. I'm so glad I was able to track you down because not everybody knows your name, but I think everybody knows your voice. And I've had a lot of guests on the program and you must be among the most heard of them. I mean, your voice is everywhere. It was so prolific. So I want to, but let's start at the beginning first. Tell me where you were born.
I was born in the state of Washington. At the city I was born in was Burlington, Washington, where my dad was principal at the high school in Anacortes, but that was the closest hospital. So that's where I was born.
And were you always singing, or when did you start singing?
Basically, I started singing at about three. I started singing songs of the day, which were like Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover and Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer and things like that, which were songs of the Second World War, which was being born right before that. So that's what I grew up singing.
And did folks encourage you, or did you know you had a special instrument, or was there someone else around you who at a young age helped encourage you?
Well, I'll be brief about this this background, because by age five, my mom had sent me and my brother to take piano lessons, and I progressed rapidly in the piano lessons. My piano teacher could be quoted by saying, "My God, you're so talented musically. I wish my son was," you know. And by the time I was in the sixth grade, I was playing some very intricate things, but I found that I'd rather play sports and stuff than continue with that. But vocally, by the time I was 11, I started really progressing rapidly, because that was my instrument. I found that with any instrument, I could pick it up and sight read and start playing it. But the problem was, I thought vocally rather than thinking the instrument. If somebody took away the music on Happy Birthday or something, I couldn't play it. You know, so, but vocally I could do anything. So that's kind of that story. And then by the time I was in the seventh grade in school, we formed a quartet, which was all of us lived within a mile from each other, and we formed a quartet and called it the Smooth Shavers, and we did a bunch of barbershop quartet stuff. And then we rapidly, by the ninth grade, we appeared on a talent contest at King TV in Seattle, and we won that. And for 2 years, my sophomore and junior year in high school, we had our own television shows, an hour show each week on King TV.
Was that just singing the hits of the day?
Yeah, we were singing hits of the day. However, we were motivated by the Four Freshmen and the High Lows and some very intricate jazz stuff. And we were a lot younger than them, but we were doing the same kind of things and doing our own arrangements. And by the time I got into college at the University of Washington, I had the rest of the quartet pledge the fraternity with me, and we won Songfest there, and then Capitol signed us, and so we went to Hollywood.
But by that time, you weren't the Smooth Shavers, right?
No. No, we finally adopted a name in Hollywood of the Eligibles, and our dream then, you know, basically when you grow up in the sticks the way we did, you either thought of some kind of celebrity or some kind of big record contract or motion pictures or things like that. Or if you were going to be in vocal music, you were a teacher or something. And there was a big discrepancy between those two things. And it wasn't till probably 2.5 years into our 7-year contract with Capitol that I came to the conclusion I was the lead singer of the group, but I came to the conclusion I'd rather be a studio singer, because I didn't enjoy celebrity. I enjoyed singing, and it was just so much more pleasant for me and rewarding for the kind of talent that I was, meaning that I never pictured myself as a celebrity. I was too shy. I was afraid to talk to people. You know, on stage, I was afraid to announce for the group or do that. But singing is another story.
Gotcha. So being in the studio is a perfect place for you. We did hear some Eligibles records earlier this morning. There's some interesting stuff there. And like you say, it's kind of a younger take on some of those more established vocal groups. And then there's also some work with Bobby V and stuff like that. Who hooked that together?
Well, that was the real breakthrough into the studios for me, because I got loosely involved with Snuff Garrett, who was very successful producing in that era, and Buzz Kaysen, who was working with Snuff. Buzz introduced me to Snuff, and through Snuff, I started doing the Bobby V stuff, and I started doing other things. And after Buzz left town, it was just specifically he was calling me to do all of his records. And that's where everything led from there to meeting the original Ross Bagdasarian, who did the Chipmunks. So I did the Chipmunks. I did that for two generations. For him and for his son. And so out of that also, later when Snuff teamed up with Leon Russell, I did the Gary Lewis and the Playboys, and Gary and I sang lead on everything, and I did all the harmony parts myself.
One of the interesting things about your career is that it embodies not just one small sliver of the music industry, but there's some 60s pop records and some sort of easy listening records and lots of TV and movie soundtracks, and later into the 70s, all kinds of pop records, all kinds of radio jingles and, you know, commercial jingles. It really kind of spread out. But the early part, the 60s, there is some very interesting things. Like, I found this record, and correct me if any of this is not actually you, because sometimes on the internet there'll be information that's not correct, believe it or not.
You got that right.
Yeah. But there's a record by the Zip Codes, and it's all songs about Mustang cars, and it seems like it's just a bunch of studio musicians and a bunch of studio singers, and there's no real group, but it seemed like during the 1960s there was a lot of that going around. So is that a project you remember at all?
I remember doing all kinds of things like that, and it was with Buzz, while Buzz was still in town, and it was the very beginning of our career. I remember even using my Volkswagen Bug as a sound on one of the records, which was really funny because, like a hot rod, you know, and here you got a Volkswagen four banger, you know. But we go out in the alley and record the sound and do all kinds of stuff. But it was it was a very exciting era. From the standpoint, I remember working when Leon and I and stuff and into the studios, it was, and with Hal Blaine, you know, we'd be sitting in there trying to figure out new sounds, to where Leon would be singing into the timpani and miking it on the other side, and Snuff would be taking our voices and running them through the Leslie speakers, and we were recording things backwards, you know, and all of those kinds of experimental sounds that were all part of the industry in those days.
I had Bones Howe on the show, and he told me that you stood a few feet behind Gary Lewis and would sort of ghost his voice, so that it was kind of thicker, so that it was more on the notes. And I also had Gary Lewis on the program, who claimed that that wasn't true at all. He also claims he plays drums on everything, but sometimes you can hear Hal Blaine counting off the song. So,
okay. Well, you know, God love him, I don't want to disagree totally, but I would like to clarify that, yes, when Snuff was doing This Diamond Ring with Leon, with Gary, he didn't know, I didn't know anything about Gary Lewis. He hadn't emerged on the scene, and I didn't know he was Jerry's son. And I was sitting at home, and they called me to come down to the studio and said, "We're recording this kid, we need some help." And I was more than happy to help, because my career really hadn't broken through the way I was hoping. And so I ran down there took my car, got down into Hollywood, and I walked in. They were recording This Diamond Ring, and they said, "You know, that we're just at a stalemate here. It's not going anywhere." And I said, "Well, let me put on a harmony part in the bridge, and that'll give it maybe a little lift there." So I designed a harmony part and sang in the bridge. When we were done with that, they said, "Yeah, that works." And then Bones, who was mixing, said exactly what he told you. He suggested, "Snuff, why don't you have Ron sing with him? It'll round out his voice a little bit." So I actually stood next to him and sang lead with him, and we did about four tracks of everything. Then I put on the harmony parts myself, and to the best of my knowledge, Hal was playing drums on everything, because he was the only one. He and I were in the studios, and there's pictures of Hal Blaine that Hal Blaine took. It showed Leon and Ron, playing piano, and Ron and Gary, and it said Ron, Gary's vocal coach, Ron Hicklin. So at that point, I remember when the record came out and it went to number one, I got a check for $25, and it was a check from Jerry Lewis. And it blew my mind, because I didn't know that was his father.
Yeah.
And I should have, you know, just had it framed and said, you know, "Thanks for the number one record, or for all you've done for my son." Because he sent me a card that said, "Thanks for all you've done for my son." And I took the $25 and cashed it immediately, because I needed the money. So we did about 10 straight top hits, and then Gary left Snuff as a producer. His choice, and then Snuff called me and asked me not to work with them anymore.
Oh.
And so I just said, "Well, you know, I'm really busy with things," so I didn't work with Gary after that.
So no more $25 checks for you.
Well, and I spent it all in one place.
Well, I will say that I like Gary's voice, and I'm sure he played drums on some album cuts probably. And, you know, his voice is unique, and it sounds great coming out of that AM radio, and it's certainly a part of the 60s. So I want to make sure we give him his due, but I agree.
Without in any of these cases, without the lead artist, all the background work and all of the other studio work that I did, to me, we weren't the ones that created the sound. They were the ones that created the print of their voice. And from that point on, everything I did and was committed to was to complement that.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes as I was listening to so much of your music this week, I was thinking that oftentimes your work is the glue that kind of holds it all together, maybe, or keeps it light, or you know what I mean? It's kind of a very important ingredient. And you know, there's records by Yellow Balloon and Gary Puckett and the Monkees and all these jingles and things. And
yes,
yeah, and it's sort of so was This Diamond Ring the first huge hit you had, the first time you heard yourself on the radio?
That was my first number one.
Yeah,
I'll give you just a brief, you know, cover a brief area there, and you can, regarding hit records, and you can stop me anytime you want. Also, I Holly Holy with Neil Diamond. I had 18 singers on that. Last Train to Clarksville, I did all the studio work. Basically, Mickey and David and Tommy and Bobby and myself. Indian Reservation, that was three of us with Mark Lindsay, which was, I think, the number one hit at that point of all time. Another interesting thing in a completely different bag is the Letterman's When I Fall in Love. If you ever listen to that hit record, you'll hear an octave above the melody, and that's me singing. They hired me to sing the melody an octave higher than they did. Also, all of the Union Gap, Gary Puck, Union Gap, Young Girl Get Out of My Life, and Woman, Woman, and Over You, and all of those. The Chipmunks, everything from there to the three tenors, which, you know, just involves, the only reason I mentioned that is because it's such a wide bag, you know, things. Yeah. With the, you know, but those kind of things, you know, excuse me.
There you go.
That was, I just flipped to something else in my songs here, and Love American Style came on.
You interrupted yourself.
Those, I'm sure you're going to get into those areas,
yeah.
But as far as those hit records, you know, Arizona with Mark Lindsay and The Candyman with Sammy Davis and Precious and Few, Climax, obviously The Partridge Family, because four of us did all the backgrounding for The Partridge Family. Four of us did all the singing except for the lead.
Except for David, yeah. There's this huge body of work. Tell me about your busiest period. What years were your busiest period, and how many sessions a day or a week would you end up singing on?
My busiest period, once I did my first number one record, which was This Diamond Ring, people start saying, who's doing that? And you don't care about the public, but you do care about the industry knowing who's doing it. And at that point, to get me on a record, they put me in charge of hiring all the other voices and stuff. So that's where the contractor aspect of it came in. You had to be a singer on the session and then hire the other voices. So I started doing that all over the town. And by 67, 66, 67, all the way through the 80s, and right up until I quit, but around 95, what happened in the industry for me is I made transitions from the initial, everything was built around the records and around the pop hits that we had done, people trying to achieve the same kind of sounds. It would be like when I did MASH, did the main title, four of us did the main title, and when Johnny Mandel called, he said, you know, you're closer to the pop industry than I am because I've been doing scoring for so long. He says, could you, you know, come in and do this thing and do this main title? So we did. And it was that kind of a thing. You made a transition into other areas because people were trying to get closer to the demographic that you'd establish with the pop records. And so you move into motion pictures, and the people I worked with there, Lalo Schifrin and John Williams and Bernstein and, oh my gosh, James Horner, I did all of James' stuff, and I just loved his writing. So everything from, you know, Glory and Apollo 13 and all those things. It was a marvelous training ground. And of course, I unfortunately didn't mention Burt Bacharach right up front, because I did, as you were just playing, I did the, we won the Academy Award score on the Butch Cassidy.
So walk me through a typical day for you, a typical busy day. Do you walk into the studio and is it typically a song you've never heard before, you don't know the melody, and you just see the sheet music and it's all sight reading? Is it just that quick?
It is, but it is only from my standpoint. I was a weird collection of talents. One, I was very good at accounting, which you don't usually say, what's the deal with an artist, you know? And most of them don't do business, don't add two and two and get four and stuff like that, because they're artistically oriented. And I was an odd collection of, I wanted my career to last. And the only way I could make it last was to continue to hit that high mark of doing hit records. And so my attention to detail was extreme. Whatever, if we were doing the Jackson 5, or if we were doing Michael or any of these things, or Sinatra, God knows, different bags, you'd bring in the right people with you to make sure that you had a chance to make that sound that made that successful. So it wouldn't be just the same group all the time. It would be borrowing from the talent pool that was out there to make sure that you hit that demographic. And so I was detail-oriented about doing that. So there were cases where if you were doing something and the composer had written, or the arranger had written all the arrangements, and that everybody being able to sight read and everybody being able to reach that climax together was very, very important to me. So you didn't have to do 20 takes to teach somebody a part. It was just, no, you just hit it while you still loved it, while it was still interesting. And you hit that mark and moved on to the next thing. I can think of one occasion where I did Dean Martin, and we did 8 sides in 2 hours. So that's how fast we would record with the right people. But secondly, just hitting that mark was one thing. If there was no chart, then we had the ability to write our own chart.
So a producer would call you in we just want some background vocals here, Ron. What can you do? And it would be up to your creation.
Exactly. There was always that element in the industry. And you'd find yourself working for people that weren't musically hip, but they were very experienced, let's say, with what would sell. And they would know it when they heard it.
It's very interesting, because you're working with, you mentioned Hal Blaine and the rest of the Wrecking Crew people. These are some seriously creative professional people who have that ability, like you said, to come in a 3-hour or 4-hour session, whatever, and cut a lot of music that they've never heard before. And I think some producers probably had a real specific thing in their head, and some didn't, and let you guys experiment, or let you bring your own thing to the project. But it must have, I mean, do you remember coming home at night feeling that you were in this vortex of creativity? All those people, even the engineers,
oh.
Yeah.
Oh my God! I remember Lalo Schifrin once said, you know, Ron, you're working around the clock. You know what? You could charge 3 times what you charge, and maybe work a little less, but you're gonna be doing great. And I said, Lalo, let me tell you something. And this is a left-handed compliment that I'm going to make here. I said, I had the opportunity to walk with kings. And I said, every time I walk in that studio, I'm in there with people that I admire, and they're having me there because they respect what I do. And so, if John Williams says, okay, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. Now, go ahead and tell everybody what to do, because you have more experience with that than I do. And, you know, then you sit down with your singers and you say, okay, here's what we're going to do. And wham, you do it.
That's,
you know,
great.
And you achieve the attitude and you sell that thing.
That's great.
So, yeah, those are the things. But it involved people that were in the embryonic stages of their career that had maybe written something or were creating something, and they wanted help. And in a lot of cases, you'd say, okay, I don't know what, listen to this and see what you guys think, you know. A good example of that was Bowling Green with the Everly Brothers. Well, the Everly Brothers didn't generally use background singers, except Bowling Green. Al Capps and I and Stan from my quartet, we did the arrangement on the spot. And it had success from that thing. And there was sounds in there. You mentioned Yellow Balloon. The Yellow Balloon was done as a head arrangement on the session, and it was my quartet. I ran over between sessions and did it and left. and I brought my quartet in, and we did it as a publisher's demo. And after I left, they said, "Can one of you guys do a lead on it?" And I went back to another session. And so Stan stayed around, and Stan from my quartet, and he put the lead on. And the next thing I knew, they released it under the name the Yellow Balloon by the Yellow Balloon.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We hadn't signed anything. It was a big magilla at the time because we were under contract.
Ah.
So all of those kinds of things happened. But all of the Yellow Balloon, the reason I mention that is because the intricate aspects of the arrangement were all ours. I mean, we did a head arrangement. There was no arrangement on the session. We just walked in and said, okay, let's do it this way, and we just did it.
Oh, it's such a lovely arrangement. Let's talk about the other side of the coin. I mean, clearly you're a professional who takes it very seriously, but I assume there's times when you walk into a session and the song is no good. You know, there's not much you can do with it. You just hold your tongue and do the best you can. Is that?
All right. You know, this is a well thought out question. I have an answer for that. People used to say to me, this would be on the session. They would say, well, what do you think? You know, what do you think of this song? And I said, you know, honestly, I don't. And they said, what do you mean by that? I said, I don't think about the song. I honestly think about the performance. Who am I going to reach with this, and how we can control our performance? Because we didn't write the song, and we didn't hire the artist, and we didn't do any of that stuff. So what you're there to do is the best you know how to do to make something successful.
Mm.
So you sit there and say, you never say, this is a piece of junk. You know, you never even acknowledge it in your mind. I don't think successfully you can do that. I think if you say everything, I don't like this bag, this is a terrible bag, well then, good luck on reaching the demographic of that bag, because that's going to show.
Yeah, that's a very smart answer, Ron. Let me remind everybody, Ron Hicklin is our guest today, and of course, we're talking about his work with the Ron Hicklin Singers, who, as we've learned, was kind of a floating group of associates, whoever was needed for a job. But definitely, there was sort of a signature sound, which I guess mostly was through your arranging. Was there other groups doing this? Was there other groups in Hollywood who were your competition?
There were... You know, all I can say are people came from all over the world to Hollywood. That's the first thing that I recognized, just like we did. And the reason you end up working a lot is because you reach that status where you are first call. And when I mean first call, if you were number one, people were trying to get you. Because if they're going to pay scale for something, why pay scale with some unknown when they can get somebody that's really produces time and time again? So what happens is after you break through and get an opportunity, no matter how long it takes, and you reach a certain level, then you're almost a fool to either say, no, I can't make the session, or two, to be out of town because... I would go for 8 years without a break, and I would work every time somebody said, Sinatra's got a session at such and such, can you make it? The answer was yes.
Yeah,
because if you said no you don't expect Sinatra to cancel his schedule to try to find out when you can make it. You know, what happens is somebody else is there.
Yeah.
And if somebody else is there and they're hungrier or better, God help you, or more cooperative or a better personality or something else, you're done.
Yeah.
You're not back. And so the answer is yes. And so I would put together things. And I know you asked earlier, and I'll answer it at this point. The most I ever did in a session was in a day was 7 sessions. And I was, when I quit, I remember I lost my voice when I was 61, and I said I was doing snow falling on cedars. And I said at the time, I said, on looking back at it, I said, I wonder what the best people are doing now when I'm with, when I contact people and say, Ron, you were the last to do 5 sessions a day. You know, you were the last, because right now we might do 5 a month. You know, and so it was that kind of a thing. The energy that was created in the music that we did in the 60s and the styles and all of that kind of stuff, it wasn't one of my biggest hits that I was involved with, but one of the things I'm really proud of is A Rock and Roll Lullaby by B.J. Thomas. If you ever get a chance, listen to that, because it was another head arrangement that I did on the date, and I just took every kind of overdone lick that was typical in the 60s, everything from the Little Darlin' thing to the Beach Boys stuff that we've done to the to the Shanana things, all of those bags, and just shoved them into that record, and including Duane Eddy guitar playing from Glen Campbell, you know, and just different things like that, and just stuck them in there. So I got a kick out of that because of the way that builds with B.J. Thomas.
You mentioned Union Scale earlier. So, and if you were doing the contracting, was it double scale, and did they pay you for your arrangements, or was that just kind of a part of the doing the job?
No, there was no pay for arrangements. It was just like whatever we can do to help.
So it was indeed, even though you were so well known, it was still Union Scale?
It was Union Scale. When I started, it was $19.50 for an hour or for a recorded side.
Yeah.
When I basically quit doing, after around the time of Indian Reservation, and when I say I quit, I mean I moved from records totally into other areas. The records were paying me scale. And what happened is, the way Union Scale worked is it would be per side, recorded side, or per hour. And there was a 2-unit minimum. So if I could do 8 sides with Dean Martin in 2 hours, then I got 8 times scale.
Gotcha.
If I did 2 hours, if I did 2 sides, or if I did 1 side in 2 hours, I'd still get 2 hours.
Gotcha.
2 scale. And so it behooved us to be fast and good and good enough to be welcome back, you know, so that it wasn't a point of just being fast. It was being hitting the mark and moving on. So that was scale. And scale for me as a contractor, when we put contractor into the thing, just to make more into our union agreements, just to make it more, put somebody in charge so there was some kind of less chaos in the session. Somebody was directly responsible. I said, I didn't care if it was $20. I didn't care what it was, just so there was somebody recognized to be in charge and to hire the voices and to get the job done. And so that's what the original intent was. It turned out to be where I'd probably get about scale and a half. When I did Indian Reservation, scale had gotten up to $30. By that time, over a decade and a half.
Do session folks, clear this up, do session folks like yourself make any royalty on anything?
No, that's the reason I said I made the transition. What I did was I was working around the clock I mean, around the clock. I averaged about 18 hours a day in front of a mic for better part of 40 years. So as I was just working around the clock, I could realize that I'm only able to make the scale times whatever time I was. So I was making in six figures, but I was making, it was a limit on that because there's only so much time and only so much energy left. And so what happened is back with the Beat Goes On, I went in 20 minutes and did a national spot for Plymouth, I think at the time. And I took two of the other guys in my group, and we went in, and we did it in 20 minutes. And I ended up getting paid for the session, and then suddenly residuals started pouring in. And I was making thousands of dollars on that. And I thought, my God, this is there's a hierarchy here of people struggling that are on the road, the people that are got their foot in place that are working in the studios, and then the people that graduated to things that paid, you know, to do them while you're still anonymous. So when I started moving and I formed my company, I built one person's company, and that's where I really got my teeth. That was Piece of Cake with Don Pystrip. I did his first session all the way till I quit, but we ended up being number one in LA, just doing all kinds of commercials and stuff. And then I left and started my own company in 83, and we won three straight Clios right out of the box on Wheaties and things like California Raisins and Levi Blues and all that stuff. And I couldn't believe how, as most lead artists are concerned, and this includes commercials, if you had somebody doing a voice for Kawasaki, a voiceover, they were signing a contract that limited them to that. With us, I could do Kawasaki, Suzuki, Honda, Yamaha. I had them all going at the same time while somebody else was doing a lead on it. And so I would hire all these things, put them together, and do them all. And when cars and beers and all those things were hitting, all the residuals were hitting from the NFL and everything else. So that said, okay, this is where we go. So I formed Killer Music and formed and built four studios for my own work in Hollywood. But at the same time, other residual things would get my attention because, like, as we talked about a little bit about motion pictures, I did about 400 of them, you know, all of the Dirty Harry stuff and all of these things that that involve different arrangers. But one of the choice jobs of my life was when Charlie Fox, and I did a bunch of things like Love American Style that played a little bit ago. When I did Love American Style and things like that with Charlie and Killing Me Softly, I did the original demo on that. And when I did those things, suddenly I went in, I got called in to start for the initial session of Happy Days. And we did the main title. And between Charlie and I worked out the arrangement for the main title, and we got it done, and I hired the voices, and we sang that, and then that turned into 11 years that I did all the music for Happy Days, and 9 years for all the music for Laverne and Shirley, including the Sound Alike records, because I would write arrangements for those things and bring in everybody, and we'd just start nailing a song every 20 minutes. And it would, every time they played them, in the shows, we were paid for having done the show. Gotcha. So in 3 days, I could record the entire season. And as people aged within the show, we would have new songs, new eras, and we would be doing that. So that was a great job. And that's still paying residuals.
That's interesting.
So that's the difference between that and records, because as record artists, we weren't getting anything. We were getting whatever that hour was.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. So, you know, you mentioned like Kawasaki. I was listening to your Kawasaki Let's the Good Times Roll jingle.
Yeah.
It's like it's perhaps the catchiest 30 seconds in the world. Were things like that cut with the vocals live? You know, what percentage of all these things we've talked about were cut with the vocals and the musicians playing at the same time?
Well, Initially, they were all done at the same time, which is one of my favorite ways to record. But later, they were, and in my own company, we would lay the tracks, and then I would go up and put on the leads, whoever I'd hired to do leads, and then we'd go out and do all the background stuff ourselves, and then we'd mix. So the voices were generally the latter part of the session. But all of that was conceived prior to that. The best part of doing everything live, which was my favorite way, was if you were in a studio with Mathis, for instance, you would have him on his mic, and the voices, if there were six or seven of us, you know, over on in a little booth on our mic, and you would have the string section, the brass section, the rhythm section, all of those spread out in the studios in their own sections. As the arranger would run something down, he said, okay, let's run this down. And if you'd sight read it, everybody'd run down, they'll try to get balances in the booth. And then suddenly, if it occurred to me that I could, I had an idea about something, I can go over to the arranger and quietly say, you know, the rhythm of this lyric would be better expressed possibly in this manner. So if we were speaking to that lyric, it would be more effective to do it this way. Do you understand what I'm saying? And they'd say, yeah. And then say, okay, in pencil, and they tell the room, in pencil, just change this rhythm to this, and let's see how it works. And suddenly, you'd run through it, and then the arranger would say, okay, put it in ink. Let's change it. Mm. Well, that was the difference between live and later. Because live, you could be, in your expertise, you could be part of the input of the success of that. Later, you could come later in the recording industry, you could come along and say, okay, we can look for perfection, but we're a synthesizer doing this. All the rhythms are there. Everything is there. We're just this chord that's going there. We can make sure that we're perfect on it, or you can punch it in at a certain point and make sure we're perfect on it. But that doesn't necessarily say, okay, our contribution was not the same. So live was much more exciting and much more a part of the development of stuff. But later, just doing things perfectly, yeah, that was easy to do.
Yeah, interesting. You know, there's, like we said earlier, there's all kinds of sessions. And into the 70s, you know, people like Leif Garrett and Cher and you know, the part, you know, all kinds of, and then even, you know, kind of you change with the time, still Graham Parsons and the Tubes and Elton John and Sparks. So it wasn't only, you know, square records. It was sort of a lot, like you said, a lot of different bags. I want to talk about, I want to name a few different things, and just briefly, like a sentence or two, if you can remember something about the session or about what happened when the record broke or whatever. I just want to just kind of go through a few of each example of each style that you guys did. Just a couple sentences or a paragraph, if you could. You know, the Love American Style theme for me is it's like your thumbprint almost. You know what I mean? It sounds to me that's the sound of Ron Hicklin right there. It's just that happy, bubbling, smooth, but the harmonies are really tightly woven together.
Yeah. A lot of that is the personnel, a lot of it is the writing, but all of it, the common denominator that I said at the time always to all my singers that I used is the reason you're here on this session is because I believe in you. You don't have to wait for me to direct you. You have to be self-directed in yourself, because you have to give the best you've got to give to everything we do. And what happens is in other people's industries, you can say, okay, this is what I used to do, or this is what I did. And there's no, there isn't the same living proof. Every mistake that we made as recording in recording that was left is a testimonial to your probably being a human being. But the thing that I tried to leave and I wanted us to leave is our recorded history had to be, whatever bag we were in had to measure up. And that kind of print that we put on things had people coming from around the world to do station breaks with us, to do all kinds of things, because they weren't the norm. They weren't the average.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Let's talk about the Partridge Family, because if you look at a picture of the Partridge Family and then you hear what those records sound like, it doesn't sound anything like what a bunch, what mostly, it's so funny to me, because David sounds like David, but the rest of the family doesn't sound like a bunch of little kids and a mom. But again,
I know.
Yeah.
But I know. But it was fashioned after the success that we had with the Monkees. And after I left the Monkees, the show went 1 year, and then it went off the air, and I came back to do one record. And I came back to do that record with David, and it was Valerie, and that was after the show was gone. So the success that we had there caused Screen Gems to give me a call back when they were putting together the idea of the Partridge Family. And Shorty Rogers called me and said, Ron, we're going to do, based on the Cowsills type of success, we're going to do this kind of idea. And I said, okay, I learned something in the past, and that's not to mess with trying to record actors. I said, I'd rather just come in and just do the thing. So when we did the pilot, I hired a group of us, and we came in, and we did the pilot. And for the first three shows or so, it was just us. And what happened is Shorty Rogers called later and said, Ron, it got the highest rating since Mission Impossible as a pilot. So he said, the show's going to go and all that stuff. He said, that's the good news. The bad news is he was being replaced. So they were going to replace him with somebody that may be closer to the record industry, which turned out to be Wes Farrell. And then at the same time, and this is well documented in the book on the subject, they came in and they said, okay, let's keep everybody that Ron had and let Ron go. So in other words, if you cut off the head, maybe everybody else will be more directable. And it's also documented in the book that the other singers refused to do it without me. So we went ahead, and the four of us, John Baylor, Tom Baylor, and Jackie Ward and myself, were the voices. But what happened is they discovered that David could sing. And when David sang, now it wasn't that Shirley couldn't sing, it was that Shirley was in a bag that was a musical comedy, and she was very, very good in that bag, but that wasn't the demographic people were trying to reach. So we were doing the singing, and they said, okay, with David even, we would do like a quarter rap on the capstan and stuff just to speed up his voice a tad, make it a little more youthful. And then there were gimmicks like that. But then again, we did all the stuff with David, and David turned out to be a huge star. And we did five gold albums, and it was an interesting few years, again, of my life that just turned out to be recording sessions. You go in and you do them and you move on, because you're not out on the road performing. You're not going into concerts. You're not doing stuff like that.
Let me ask you about, I was listening to this Hugo Montenegro Lady in Cement track.
Uh-huh.
Very much the vocals, like, as you said earlier, are sort of an instrument. You know, it's very, very much just part of the, you know, like a soloing instrument throughout the thing. Were those sessions a little more difficult than a pop record?
Well, the beauty of the relationship I had with Hugo, and I loved Hugo, but the Lady in Cement, I did a number of albums with Hugo, and we would do classical gas and Good Vibrations and all of the songs of the Dame MacArthur Park and things like that. And all of the spaghetti Western stuff, you know, all of those things. And every one of them, Hugo was arranging from a jazz standpoint. So the voices that I was bringing in, we would come in and we'd pick up the chart and we'd sight read it and just start cranking them out. And I remember Jorge Calandarelli telling me years later that he'd come up from Argentina or wherever he was from, and he'd set into a session, and he watched us pick up a chart and sight read it at RCA, and he thought, I'm going back home, back where they stood around a piano and tried to learn something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's some very complex stuff there. Let's talk about something less complex. Am I right that it's you guys on the Batman theme, singing Batman?
Oh, yeah.
It's one word.
I'll interrupt you with a story on that. It's when we did that, there was three guys and three girls or something like that. And I was clear up on the highest note up there. There was a girl and a guy on each part. And it was very high. It was up in the soprano register. And it was real strident. And we hit those. And anyway, Bill Cole, who was one of the guys, where it says on the music, says Words and Music by Neil Hefti, he put Word and Music.
That's
so that
genius.
Was the Batman session.
That's perfectly fine. Yeah, it's funny how, though, you know, a song with one word is one of your most well-known recordings. You mentioned Climax, Precious and Few. That's kind of like one of those songs that kind of signals the end of the Wrecking Crew and the end of the Top 40 era. Could you see that change was coming, that sort of more self-contained bands were coming in? Did you see that coming down the highway?
Not really, because I was moving. I was saying, you know, I had done 25 albums with Ray Conniff, for instance, and I had all the singers on that, and Ray just wouldn't record without me. And what, bless his heart, Ray would sit there and say, Ron, it's my band. And I said, yeah, but Ray, they're here because I brought them in, and I can communicate with them, and I can tell them what we need. You just tell me what you want, and I'll get it done for you. And it was that kind of an arrangement that we had. And so he just started writing everything around us, doing lead, me doing lead, or, you know, within the group, the guys doing this stuff. And it was an era that while I was working night and day, and still building these commercial companies and everything else. And finally somebody said, you know, you ought to knock off some of that stuff. And I decided, well, you know, maybe I should. And then devote it to stuff that really pays for me to do it. And so that's when I started making the transition. But that record, Climax, that was Tom Baylor actually hired me to do that, and it was Tom and I and his wife and a girlfriend. Which, now just between us and the world, I never did that. I never hired platonically that way. I didn't want anything to do with the objectivity of doing the best I knew how. But that was a hit, and it was a kind of a transition, as you said.
You talked about your sort of professional ability to take yourself, your judgment out of a session and to just think about delivering. But like when you're listening to playback of Precious and Few, did you think this is going to be a giant hit? Did that light go off?
No. I'd like to say that it did.
Yeah.
Because when I listened to things, I was listening to what we could do better, and I heard warts all over in
that. That's so
and
interesting.
And I kept thinking, "Oh, we can do that," but I wasn't in charge.
You're an unusual guy, and I mean that in the nicest way. I mean, I think that's why you were able to achieve so much. You know, it's amazing. Yeah, and one of the things that I think people need to understand is a lot of people used you or your group and named it something else, like the Ray Conniff Singers or the Charles Fox Singers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was just you all the way through. Tell me about, just quickly, tell me, you worked sometimes with Thurl Ravenscroft.
Thurl Ravenscroft, right.
And a lot of folks know his voice from Tony the Tiger, things like that. He had a super, super deep voice. Was he the lowest singer you've ever encountered?
No. One of the first movies I ever did, when I came to town, it was just like they were hiring so deep into this movie that we got called on it, and that was Music Man. And I was in there with like 70 singers, and I was a kid, basically, and I'm 19 years old or so, and I'm sitting amongst the best talent I've ever heard in my life. And most of them, because I'd grown up listening to radio and everything else, most of them I could recognize their voices. I had no idea who they were. I didn't know their names, but I had the greatest respect for the fact that they could sight read so well, and they were great singers. Well, Thurl was on that, but there was also a guy named Delos Juice, who was possibly as low or lower than Thurl, but that might be the only. There was a spot in that movie where he says, "Providing they are contrary," and as he said, sang that, he went way down there to that. But on one session I did with Julie London, I had Thurl singing a pedal F. Now a pedal F is way to hell down there. And Thurl said to me later, he says, "Can I get a recording of that?" He says, "That's the first time I've ever sung that note."
Well, to be able to sing that low, but do it on pitch is super, super tough. Yeah.
Well, that's the whole thing. I never asked people to do something I didn't think that they couldn't do, because the secret to me to be successful is to make sure that you're exposing that which you can do well. And then people say, "My God, that's incredible." You know, but if you're out there exposing your soft underbelly, nobody's going to be impressed at all. You know, they're going to say, "Oh, I can do that." So,
you mentioned the Beach Boys earlier. Did you do any Beach Boys sessions?
Yes, I did. And the interesting thing is, by the time I was doing some of the Beach Boys, so Glenn Campbell and I were signed to Capitol together. So doing Ricky Nelson and all of that era, that's where I met Jerry Fuller, who did all of the writing for the Union Gap and production and all that stuff. And Jerry was baritone. Al Capps, my bass in my quartet, was singing bass. Glenn was singing second tenor, and I was singing top tenor. We were backing Rick Nelson. And so all of that kind of spread, because Glenn had been doing the Beach Boys. And I got a call to do a number of things with the Beach Boys, for the Beach Boys and independently in productions that they were doing. And so the first time I showed up at Brian's home, which for some reason was painted purple, at the chagrin, I'm sure, of all of his neighbors. But we walked into the living room, and the living room, he had the mic set up, but there was 6 inches of sand, you know, instead of rugs or something. It was 6 inches of sand on the floor, and the mic set up and that and all that stuff. And I thought, gosh, this is really weird. But what a wonderful talent, you know, Bryant was over the years. And I must admit, my favorite album was Pet Sounds. And so I was honored to be a part of those things.
So what era of Beach Boys recordings are you guys on?
Well, I'd like to be able to answer that, but I don't. I don't know the answer to that, because I never, you know, what happened is the connection was so, one of my dear friends was Tony Asher. Through Tony, when Brian got a little scrambled later, we would rip off things like from Good Vibrations and put them into commercials, you know, that real high part where it just rings off into silence and then starts cooking again after.
Yeah, yeah.
I did that in a McDonald's commercial, and it came off so, and Of course, the singers I use, we can nail all that stuff easily. As a matter of fact, we could nail it easier than the Beach Boys could because they work at it. And, you know, they developed it. And all we did is just say, here's the bag, and then just do it. Wham! You know? So anyway, Tony later showed this thing that I had done to Brian, and Brian listened to it, and he said, oh, my God, that's great. Do you mind if I use that sometime? And I, back in those days, I said, oh, my God, I can't believe that we ripped him off. He was wanting to know if he could use it sometime.
You mentioned not knowing, and it's interesting because of the nature of your job, sometimes it would behoove the artist not to credit you, right? People want the audience to think that it's them, and it's so there is no definitive list of your recordings. I mean, not even close. What's online?
Yeah, right. No, that's such a well phrased question there, because what happened is, as we did all those motion pictures, you know, The Hunt for Red October, you know, all the stuff we did in Russia, all of those things that I did, people would say, well, I didn't see your name in the credits. I said, well, if you saw who catered the lunches, they would have been there, but we wouldn't have. we and a lot of the musicians would not have been noted. And we grew up in the area where what I recognized is one, be low profile to everybody in the public. We're not a celebrity. But two, be very high profile as far as the people hiring, because they want to know who can get the job done.
Real quickly, do you remember working with Keith Moon? Was he in the room when you cut a Keith Moon record? Crazy Like a
No,
Fox?
I don't remember. I do not remember that.
Fair
there
enough.
There is a lot of the records where the artist would not be there. There were because they'd already laid their part down. But most of the time they were. There were other things that I can point at to where it's somebody like White Punks on Dope, The Tubes, even Elton John, different recordings that we'd done, that I was in and out of there doing them so fast that I don't even remember what I did. It's when things, you know, later we would hear, okay, Blue Moods went platinum. Okay, well, that's the album name. I don't even remember what we sang on it. And we would do so many of those things. While I was talking here, I was flashing back onto the Chipmunks, which would be a good example of the idea of the day. If people were led to believe that the Chipmunks were the Chipmunks, they were singing. So if you say no, and you put three names with that, it wasn't the same thing. And so there's an album out there, right after I did the Beatles stuff, there's an album out there that said the Chipmunks sing with children. And we did a bunch of stuff like whatever. Anyway, there's a picture on that album, and it shows Ross Bagdasarian, who was David Seville and the creator, and it shows Pete King, who was the arranger on the session, and it shows Jimmy Joyce, who contracted the kids singers on the session, and then me. And we're standing there with a piece of music, and we're looking at all that, and there's never any mention of who I am. But it's funny because it's a picture on the back of the album, and who I was Alvin. and there's your picture, but nobody's acknowledging because you don't exist.
Gotcha. So is that you on the Chipmunks Sing the Beatles?
Yeah.
I love that record. That's a fantastic record. One more time, it's Ron Hicklin is our guest. So you retired after, I guess, building up your companies into these giant companies, and now you live half your time in Hawaii, so nobody feels sorry for you, no matter what happens.
No.
What's the last thing that you sang on? Do you remember?
Yes, I definitely do. The last thing I sang on, because I lost my voice on that session, and it turned out to be a problem where I could never get it back, and that was Snow Falling on Cedars. We were about 14 hours into the call, and everybody was coughing and hacking and stuff like that, and Sally Stevens had contracted the session. And because I would never walk out on somebody for any reason and leave them stuck, people were leaving because it had gone over the 8 hours that people expected, and I was still trying to gut it through. And I realized that that when I would take a breath, I would want to cough. And so I finished the session, and I called my wife and said, I'm coming home, and I want you to take me to the hospital. And we went to the hospital, and I was in there for about 3 hours. And they did every kind of examination, and they said, they gave me a bunch of stuff, and they said, don't sing for a while. And I had gone, as I said, 18 hours a day for 40 years in front of a microphone, and my voice was just never in trouble. I could do anything with it. And suddenly, and it wasn't nodes or anything like that. It's some kind of a spasmodic thing. And so later, I started calling people that were trying to hire me and saying, I can't make it. I'm not well for it. And what happened is about 6 months later, I decided to just sing from a congregation standpoint for some Christmas carols that I was sitting at a pew. And as I started to move my vocal cords, I would start to cough again, realizing that everything that I'd taken for granted my whole life, I didn't even realize that if I was going to hit a high ooh or something, before I ever did it, my vocal cords moved to that position and I just did it. And now just moving them, suddenly I started to cough and everything. And I said, yeah, thank you, God. It was a wonderful career. And that's kind of the way it was.
Wow. That's tough. I mean, that is so tough. It's like having your trumpet get run over by a steamroller or something. It's over.
Yeah.
Wow.
But at the same time, I look back on it and say I had a one of a kind career.
Oh, that, absolutely.
That really paid off extremely well, because right up to the point where I quit, my reputation was there for the work that I did and everything. And it wasn't that I wanted to. I always dreamed that I could quit as number one, but I didn't realize that I would be forced to.
But it sounds like you're happily retired. Am I correct?
I am, and I have been. I kind of devoted my attention then to playing the golf that I never had a chance to play.
In the end, do you have a favorite of all the stuff you've worked on?
Yeah, I really still look at it as if I go from Holly Holy, or I go to Last Train to Clarksville, or Indian Reservation, or any of these things, what I'm listening to, and what is really making me pleased, is how I did the job. I never even realized it so much as when I retired. When I retired, there were all kinds of tapes and things like that that were around that were gonna die a death. Of not being used or not played or anything else. And I was moving so quickly from one gig to the next that I never bought anything and I never had a chance to listen to it except when we'd hear it on the air. It was like Hal Blaine. He'd walk into a session and he'd have a chart, and he'd show me that in the top 100 he had 15 of them. And I had the same ones, and he'd have them circled in red, and I'd have the same ones, and we would laugh about it, and do stuff like that. That was the energy. That was the love of what we did and what we put into it. But later, as you ask about favorites, I just still go back and look at whatever the bag was. And every one of those things that I would mention, from Last Train to Clarksville to the Norman Luboff Choir, or any of these things, or to this diamond ring, there are different bags in there Dan, some of those musical genres don't require as much ability as others, but they still have a demographic. And if you cannot reach that demographic, then you're not doing the thing justice. And I listen to all that stuff, and I feel very proud of the fact that all the successes that we had in different areas managed to say, without any name credit or anything else, we were singing through the mic and reaching the demographic of that style of music. We weren't teaching them what something ought to be. We were pleasing them with what we did. And that is my favorite.
Gotcha.
Not just one of the songs.
Gotcha. Well, it is amazing when you put a bunch of people in a room to try to achieve catchiness, it's such a very interesting goal, and you definitely succeeded so many times. Well, I've got Love American Style queued up now because it's such a signature piece for you guys. Ron, this has been so fascinating. I mean, what a interesting time, it's almost just the history of America in a way, just a time that's gone away, that's changed, but like you said, the music always will be here forever, and people will be listening to your voice forever.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say to that is, now when somebody says, "Who did you record with?" I say, "Well, I even did the Beatles," and they'll say, "Who's that?"
What?
You say, "What the hell?"
What?
I say, "Come and take me now."
yeah, we've lived too long.
Some people are just too young.
Well, thanks, Ron. This has just been fantastic.
Thank you, Michael, very much. I appreciate your questions, and they're well thought out. And thank you very much for honoring me with the call.
Love American style, truer than the red, white, and blue. That's me and you. And on a star-spangled night, my love,
come to me.
You can rest your head on my shoulder, while by the dawn's early light, my love, I will defend your right to try.
You know, but right before I do this, I got to tell you a quick story.
Sure.
Because this one, I was in doing a McCulloch Chainsaw commercial once, and they heard me talking to the group, and they called me at home after we were done recording, and they said, "Ron, you're the voice. You're the voice we want to represent McCulloch Chainsaw. Come on in." And I said, "But I'm not a voiceover. I don't do that stuff." And they said, "Well, come on in." So I thought, well, you call me. I didn't call you. So I went into the studio afterwards, and I sit down, and I'm standing there trying to put earphones on. They said, "You don't need earphones. Just stand at the mic and give us your statement." And they said, "It's McCulloch, 99.95. And I said, "Okay." And I stood there feeling very lonely. There was no group. And I said, "Oh, McCulloch, 99.95. They said, "Just do it like yourself. Oh, McCulloch, 99.95. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, chainsaw, I got to be masculine. I got to do John Wayne or something. And so I'm doing this, and they finally, take 25. I hear from the booth. And he says, finally in the booth, he says, "Shit, McCulloch, 99.95. That's what they said. And I said, "Shit, McCulloch, 99.95. And they said, "Fine, edit off the shit, that's it." And I swear to God, I got all kinds of money on that commercial for the being the voiceover and all that stuff. And I thought, oh, my God. Well, here I am again. Let me try this. Okay.
I'm sorry. You can skip it, Ron. You've given
me... No, I'll try one more.
Okay.
This is Ron Hicklin. Thanks for listening to WFMU and Michael. Thank you.
The Ron Hicklin Singers.
The Ron Hicklin Singers?
A-M-U.
Yeah.
Mac, why do you...
Ron Hicklin. Hey, the Ron Hicklin singers.
Ron Hicklin always did like this.
Love American style, truer than the red, white, and blue.
Love, there's an easier way to do this, you know.
No, really? Do what?
Oh, show them who the Ron Hicklin singers are. And tell them that, well, they can get the same vocal group on products from TM Productions.
Uh-huh. Well, what's the better way?
Well, first of all, we turn off the set.
Hey, what kind of a set is that?
Don't worry about it. And now we turn on the 16-track.
You've got a 16-track recorder in your dining room?
Don't worry about that either. We can take certain liberties. Now, what I want to do is play this TM cut for you.
People who make a good day better, WSBA. You're keeping company with people who care.
It's like this. TM makes custom products. You can choose the type of music, and you can choose the type of vocal. That's the message.
WSBA.
And the optional group is the Ron Hicklin Singers, huh?
You got it. Now, all we have to do is describe the group a little further.
Oh, sure. Well, Hicklin has a mustache. He's about 6 foot.
No. Let's try it this way.
Right, you're acting like a teeny bopper runaway child.
What are we listening to Mark Lindsay for in the middle of this demo?
Hold on. We're listening to our group, too.
Those are the Ron Hicklin Singers, huh?
Yeah. They've been the backup group for Mark Lindsay, the Raiders, Andy Williams, Ringo.
Oh, my, my. Oh, my, my. You can boogie. You can
boogie. And Wayne Newton, Gary Puckett, Bobby Sherman, Cher.
Stop letting it laugh and dance and lit the candles one by one. Dance to her.
Then there's Neil Diamond, Michael Jackson.
That's pretty impressive.
Well, check this out. Those are performers they've backed up. And now, I'm about to reveal a startling industry secret. Ron Hicklin and Company were also the group for the Monkees.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
The group? Essentially. Most of the voices you've heard on Monkees records have really been the Ron Hicklin Singers. And it's the same with everything this group has done.
I think I love you.
No, there's David Cassidy, but the rest is pure Hicklin.
Pure R.H.
Did you know that Gary Lewis is really mostly Ron Hicklin?
No, and did you know that Sonny Bono was really Connie Stevens?
It's no put on.
No?
Now, you may ask, what about movie scores?
I was just thinking I might ask that.
Well, it's our old friends again, doing the vocal parts and the theme from Rosemary's Baby, Dirty Harry, Maine, Lady in Cement. Music Man, MASH, Daryl Cuckoo, Guide for the Married Man, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Hang 'em High. Now, Ray Charles, Burt Bacharach, 10 different chorus leaders have used the Ron Hicklin Singers as their vocal sound at some time. And you know, we're only scratching the surface here.
Well, you gotta learn how to take care of your records.
But you see, they've all heard the Ron Hicklin Singers before. They may not have known them by name, but the sound's been there, coast to coast. And after you catch these little items they've done, you're gonna say, oh, they're the ones.
Kawasaki, let's a good time draw. Kawasaki, let's a good time draw. Come to your Western Auto Store.
Sears has everything.
You deserve a break today. Close by, right on your way at McDonald's.
Well,
oh, they're the ones.
Well, that's Ron Hicklin.
And the Singers.
And the Singers. What do you think?
Aren't you going to tell them about Hicklin's Most Valuable Player Awards or the write-up in the Wall Street Journal?
No. Coily allowed you to sneak that in right there.
All right. Then I guess what you're trying to say is that these singers are available to anyone, huh?
I think that says it pretty well.
Good times, good vibes, and feeling fine. Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Ron Hicklin Singers, the vocal alternative.
Got it all in line.
Available now for the country, for broadcasters, and you.
And you.